Hello and welcome. Today I'm going to talk about the record and the legacy of President Ronald Reagan. I'm focusing on Reagan because he's a hero for millions of Americans who call themselves conservatives and for many other Americans. In fact, recent public opinion polls show that Ronald Reagan and John F. Kennedy are considered the greatest American presidents of the 20th century. But the main point I'm going to make in this broadcast is to show how the reality of the Reagan presidency, the reality of his record, and the reality of what happened to America during the time that he was president from January 1981 to January 1989 is very, very different, in sharp contrast to the rhetoric, the image, and the illusion of the Reagan years. Because Ronald Reagan left the presidency more than 20 years ago, many of those who might be listening to this broadcast may be too young to have any kind of personal memory or recollection of the Reagan years and the impact of his presidency in this country. But for older people, Reagan stands out from the other presidents before and after him, largely because of his rhetoric, because of the way he spoke. He was called, not without reason, the great communicator. He had been, after all, a movie actor for much of his career. And even after he left motion pictures, he spent many years as a spokesman for the General Electric Company. But he first came onto the national scene, in political terms, in 1964, shortly before the election in November of that year. He came out with a national televised address on behalf and in support of Barry Goldwater, who was the Republican candidate that year, and it was called Mr. Conservative by many Americans. Ronald Reagan took something of a chance in endorsing Barry Goldwater because Goldwater went down to defeat in an overwhelming victory for Lyndon Johnson. But as I said, just shortly before the election, Ronald Reagan gave an address that was widely broadcast in the United States and was so effective, so influential, so persuasive to so many people who saw it that immediately, even though Barry Goldwater was the candidate and was defeated, people began talking right away about Ronald Reagan as a great hope for the Republican Party and especially for conservatives in the future. This speech, which many American conservatives called the speech, laid out his philosophy very, very effectively. And as I said, when Ronald Reagan spoke, he rather properly, rightly, was called the great communicator. I think he's the last American president who, when he said the things that all politicians do about how great and wonderful this country is, said it with a conviction that I think was sincere. Whereas many politicians now who mouth similar phrases and talk in the same way do so without any real conviction, and the public senses it. Barack Obama or Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney may mouth the same kind of words and rhetoric that Ronald Reagan did, but Ronald Reagan is perhaps the last American political leader who really believed that America's greatest days are still to come. Another reason that we're very unlikely ever to have an American president like Ronald Reagan is because he came of age before World War II and before even the Depression years of the 1930s. He's the last American president who grew up in an era when the federal government was really much, much smaller, that is, before the Franklin Roosevelt years, than it later became under the administration of FDR. He remembered fondly an old America, an America of old Courier and Ives engravings and pictures, a nostalgic America that he remembered with a fondness because he experienced it in a way that no other American president or political leader since then can really communicate effectively because they haven't lived through it themselves. Ronald Reagan, in several speeches, talked about his view of America in a way that I think sums up his general outlook on the United States of America, an almost religious outlook that appeals very strongly to something in the American character. In January 1974, Ronald Reagan, when at the time still governor of the state of California, said this: "You can call it mysticism if you want to, but I have always believed that there was some divine plan that placed this great continent between two oceans to be sought out by those who were possessed of an abiding love of freedom and a special kind of courage. This was true of those who pioneered the great wilderness in the beginning of this country, as it is also true of those later immigrants who were willing to leave the land of their birth and come to a land where even the language was unknown to them." Reagan repeated this same view several years later as president in a speech given in 1986. And on that occasion he said, again in very similar words, "Call it mysticism if you will, but I have always believed there was some divine providence that placed this great land here between the two great oceans to be found by a special kind of people from every corner of the world who had a special love of freedom and a special courage that enabled them to leave their own land, leave their friends and their countrymen, and come to this new and strange land to build a new world of peace and freedom and hope." Well, the sentiment of Ronald Reagan sort of sums up, I think, the almost religious, certainly, as he puts it, mystical view of America, a sort of feel-good view of America, shared by millions of Americans, especially those who consider themselves conservative. But as appealing or as self-satisfying as this view might be, after all, he's telling his audience that, and telling Americans that they're really a better people, a more courageous, or a people more imbued with a love of freedom than anybody else on earth, no matter how good that might make people feel about themselves, it is, as he says, a really mystical, even an entirely rhetorical idea of America and the world. Consider for a few minutes these points about this view of America. For one thing, apparently it doesn't apply to the people who were already living in America before it was discovered, as they say, by Christopher Columbus and settled by Europeans. After all, if the Native Americans who were here also share the same love because they happened to come here earlier and not as immigrants, well, then a love of the land or a love of freedom that brings people to a new place would apply to everybody and their descendants all over the world. But presuming he's talking about the immigrants who came after the Columbus landing, and mainly from Europe, then he's not including American Indians in his vision of this special breed of people with a special love of freedom. Equally, this vision that Reagan lays out doesn't apply for black Americans who are descended from slaves. After all, it wasn't a love of freedom that brought them to the United States. They were brought here in chains, in bondage. So they're not included in this, as he puts it, mystical view of America. But more than that, if a country settled by immigrants is somehow intrinsically a country of people of greater courage and love of freedom, well, then that should apply equally well to other countries that have been settled by immigrants who came in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. For example, Canada is largely settled as well by immigrants, and the people who live there today are either immigrants or descendants of immigrants. It's true as much of Canada as it is of the United States. But apparently, this mystical view of the United States doesn't apply to that country. But Canada and the United States aren't alone either. Australia is a country also settled overwhelmingly by immigrants or descendants of immigrants, largely from the British Isles. That's also true of New Zealand. It's also true of Argentina, which is populated by people who came from Spain or Italy or are descendants of those people who came from those countries. But so even a few minutes of thought and reflection should be enough to show just how limited this, as Reagan admits, somewhat mystical view of America really is. But it's important to understand this point of view because it helps to explain much about Reagan's actions as President of the United States and of the worldview of American conservatives. In recent election campaigns, one issue that Republicans generally are pretty united about is their opposition and opposition to illegal immigration and their unhappiness that America is being flooded by millions of illegal immigrants, especially from Mexico. Well, this was an issue also when Ronald Reagan was president. And as president, he signed into law the Simpson-Mazzoli Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. This was a very much debated and important immigration reform bill at the time. Now, one of the most remarkable features of this bill is that even though it was signed into law by Ronald Reagan, who considers himself conservative, it contained a provision that most people who call themselves conservatives today or Republicans would reject. It contained an amnesty provision. The Simpson-Mazzoli immigration bill included a provision that granted legal status to illegal aliens who could prove that they had entered the United States since January 1st, 1982. Now, it's a little unclear just why January 1st, 1982 should be such a significant cutoff date. But even at the time, the Simpson-Mazzoli bill was very heatedly debated, and critics pointed out that by granting amnesty to millions of people or large numbers of people on the basis of this law would certainly encourage even more illegal immigration. After all, if immigrants could be count on amnesty in this bill, they could have at least some hope that if they snuck in, that another bill would also grant them legal status in the United States of America. And the critics also warned not only about that, but that no immigration reform bill was going to really be successful unless it was really serious about deporting illegal aliens and punishing those who came into the country illegally. Well, the Simpson-Mazzoli bill didn't do that, and Ronald Reagan signed it into law. It was not serious about real enforcement of immigration laws, and within a few years it was very obvious that this amnesty bill, this Simpson-Mazzoli immigration bill that Reagan had approved, had largely been a failure because it was based on a essentially short-sighted view of America, a kind of view that, well, things will take care of themselves if we just do something here. But more importantly, the amnesty provision of this bill is entirely consistent with Ronald Reagan's worldview. After all, if America is really a great country because it's settled by people who had to overcome adversity to come here, then in a sense, the people who violated the law or climbed over borders or climbed over walls or swam rivers in order to get to this country are more real Americans, according to this Reagan worldview, than are those who come here illegally. because the illegal immigrants had to overcome more adversity and run more risk, presumably, than those who even came legally. So, essentially, Reagan's worldview, as laid out in the quotes that I gave earlier, make it very difficult to really crack down on immigration at all anyway. And that's one of the features of that. And that's one of the interesting contrasts and contradictions between Reagan's legacy, which Republicans like to embrace, and the reality that he supported one of the most important amnesty bills in American history. For those people who defend Reagan's legacy, they try to emphasize that the economy improved under his 8 years as president. Well, that's true. The economy did get better. Unemployment fell. Reagan, in fact, got elected because out of tremendous dissatisfaction with the administration, 4-year administration of President Jimmy Carter. And Reagan's victory was all the more impressive because he defeated a president, that is Carter, who was running for re-election. But the Reagan legacy is based upon the memory that he was able to restore prosperity and a sense of confidence, and also that he, allegedly anyway, cut taxes and reduced the size of government, rebuilt America's military strength, and, his defenders say, won the Cold War. Well, that legacy is really a very mixed one and different than the image and the reputation that his supporters defend. In fact, the reality of the 8 years of the Reagan presidency is very different than the one that he laid out when he was running for office. Over and over again, Ronald Reagan hammered away on the theme that the best government is the least government. Less government is best. And he over and over pledged how he, as president, was going to reduce the size of government. In fact, one line that he liked to use in speeches that he could always be sure would get a hearty round of applause is this one. He used it in quite a few speeches. The 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." He would always say that government isn't the solution, government is the problem. Well, the reality was that as president, Ronald Reagan actually greatly increased the number of the government officials. In short, he made worse the very thing that he said was such a great problem, that is, big government. When he was campaigning for the presidency in 1980, during the primary campaign, his opponent was George H.W. Bush, father of George W. Bush, and he called Reagan's economic plan as president voodoo economics. It was impossible because Reagan was promising to increase military spending, cut the size of government, and reduce taxes all at the same time. Well, in fact, he wasn't able to do it. In fact, during his administration, there was something of an embarrassment when his own budget director, a man named Stockman, in an interview even acknowledged that what the Reagan administration, what President Reagan was promising, simply could not be carried out. Well, that's in fact what happened. The Reagan administration, rather than decreasing government, greatly increased government spending. Increased it not only for the military, but also increased it even for human services, something that Reagan was always and continually condemning. The federal budget deficit increased enormously during the Reagan presidency. The national debt increased enormously during his presidency. Federal spending, in fact, by 1989, that is, after 8 years of the Reagan presidency, it increased by 69% from 1981. In 1980, Jimmy Carter's last year as president, the federal government spent 28% of the national income. But during the Reagan years, he increased this percentage. One aspect of the Reagan presidency that many of his defenders like to point to was that he had cut taxes. Well, to some degree, that's true. But in fact, the tax rate has gone down even after the Reagan years. One fact about the Obama presidency is that remarkably, that conservatives would like the public to forget, and in fact very few of them will acknowledge, is that the federal tax rate, both for individuals, individual tax rate, and the tax rate for corporations, is actually lower under President Obama than it was for 7 of the 8 years of the Reagan administration. So, in terms of tax rates, even on that score, Obama is actually more, quote, conservative, unquote, than Ronald Reagan was. More specifically, for 7 of Reagan's 8 years in office, the top tax rate was higher than the current 35%. In 6 of those years, it was 50% or more. And in every year that Reagan was in office, the bottom tax bracket was higher than the current 10%. For a family of 4, the average income tax rate under Reagan in 1983 was 11%. Under Clinton, later a Democrat, it fell to 9.18%. And under Obama in 2002, it was down to 4.68%. And also, although it's true that Ronald Reagan was able to cut taxes initially when he came into office, in 7 of his 8 years in office, the Reagan administration and the federal government actually increased taxes, including 4 times in just 2 years. One of the most important events that happened during the Reagan presidency was the invasion by Israel of Lebanon in 1982. Several years ago, a speaker at an IHR conference was a former U.S. Congressman, Pete McCloskey, a moderate or liberal Republican who represented a district in Northern California. He spoke about the power and the machinations of the Zionist Anti-Defamation League in his talk, and he spoke more specifically about his opposition to the use by Israel in its invasion of Lebanon of cluster bombs supplied by the United States. Now, this was significant because these horrific weapons were supplied to Israel on the basis that they would be used only for defensive purposes, only if Israel was invaded by another country. In fact, Israel used these weapons during its illegal invasion of Lebanon in 1982, a very destructive campaign that resulted in enormous loss of life in Lebanon. When Pete McCloskey spoke publicly against Israel's use of these weapons in violation of American law, the initial response by Israel was to lie. It denied that it was even using these weapons. But McCloskey was informed confidentially by people in the U.S. military and in the State Department that Israel was in fact using these weapons and that they were being used in violation of even United States law. Well, even though Israel denied it, McCloskey kept on hammering away at this issue. Well, we'll take a break at this point, and I'll resume in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast. Hello, and welcome back. In this broadcast, I'm talking about the record and the legacy of Ronald Reagan, and what his legacy says about America, and especially about the conservative view of American life, American politics. I was talking more specifically when we went on break about the events in 1982 in Lebanon when Israel invaded that country, and I was talking about how former U.S. Congressman Pete McCloskey, who addressed a IHR conference some years ago, spoke about how Israel was violating U.S. law in using U.S.-supplied cluster bombs in Lebanon. As I mentioned, when Pete McCloskey first complained about this in the Congress, Israel responded initially by lying about its role and claiming that it wasn't using cluster bombs. Well, McCloskey was told in confidence by people in the U.S. military and in the State Department that, in fact, Israel was using these weapons, these bombs, in violation of American law, and he persisted until finally, actually, some of them were samples were brought forward, and eventually Israel acknowledged it. But typically, and this is another feature of the Reagan administration, for all the talk about upholding the Constitution and defending America's honor, the Reagan administration did nothing to call Israel to account for this violation, not just of international law, which the invasion of Lebanon was, but even this violation of U.S. law. Reagan was a staunch supporter of Israel, and that's one of the reasons why his reputation is still as good as it is in the United States. But more specifically, as the chaos came over the country of Lebanon in the wake of Israel's invasion of that country in 1982, Ronald Reagan decided to send U.S. Marines to Lebanon, and American troops began landing there, arriving in September 1982. In fact, Reagan insisted that the purpose of the American role was to strengthen the Lebanese armed forces so that they would have a stable government, one that would also presumably be one acceptable to the United States and the U.S. interests in that country. Well, things changed drastically in October 1983, on October 23rd, when a truck laden with 6 tons of explosives exploded at a U.S. Marine barracks in Lebanon, collapsing a 4-story building and killing 241 American Marines, soldiers, and sailors. Now, even after the bombing of the Marine barracks, President Reagan insisted that U.S. forces would not be driven out. I was young at the time, but I remember very vividly how Reagan pledged that this attack on the U.S. Marine barracks was not going to deter America from its mission in Lebanon. But the outrage and the disgust of the American public and of the world with this was so great that a few months later, Ronald Reagan changed course and announced that U.S. Marines would be, as he put it at the time, deployed. Well, what he meant is he was pulling them out. And the result was that the lives of these American Marines in Lebanon, in fact, the U.S. role intervening in Lebanon in 1982, was a failure, a fiasco. And that was just one aspect of the Reagan legacy. Largely in part as a expression of America's support, consistent throughout the Reagan years, and, of course, in keeping with that of other American presidents, of making sure that U.S. policy was in accord with Israel and its interests, reflected also in the fact that Reagan never called Israel to account or punished Israel for its violation of U.S. law, much less of international law, in the invasion of Lebanon in 1982. Like many of those who are listening to this broadcast, I get a lot of email messages every day, certainly every week. Most of them, of course, are not personal. They're sent out by people who distribute them to many others, and they contain things that the sender thinks everybody ought to hear and see and read and so forth. And I also included among those are messages from people who hate Barack Obama. They're convinced that he's really a secret Muslim, that he's not really loyal to the United States. And any scrap of behavior, anything that he says or does that can be cited to call into question his loyalty to America, or that can be used to show that he might be secretly sympathetic to Muslims, is cited by these people to criticize Barack Obama. Well, I'm mentioning this not to harp on Barack Obama or on the critics of Obama, as much as to highlight probably the most embarrassing chapter of the Reagan years, and that's the so-called Iran-Contra affair. Now, at the time, it was an enormously big thing, and many Americans, including many of those who might be listening, may not know or remember what it was all about. What it was that the Reagan administration, which had pledged that it would never make a deal with terrorists, as it called them, secretly made an arrangement to sell weapons to the Islamic regime in Iran, which the State Department at the time was calling an instigator of terrorism, in the hopes that Iran would help release American hostages who were being held in Lebanon at the time. In addition to that, profits from the secret sale of weapons to Iran were supposed to be used by people in the Reagan administration to support anti-communist rebels in Nicaragua, the so-called Contra rebels, again, in violation of laws and amendments passed by the Congress specifically forbidding the U.S. government to support the Contras. And as part of this Iran-Contra deal, this secret arrangement with Iran to support a secret war effort in Nicaragua, high-level U.S. officials secretly visited Iran, in fact brought gifts to Iranian leaders. Now, I've often reflected that if a high-level official, or more than one, currently much less more than one American official, high-level official of the Obama administration, were to secretly visit the Islamic Republic of Iran and meet with President Ahmadinejad or other high Iranian officials, this would be immediately cited by people who hate Barack Obama as proof that he's disloyal, that he's probably secretly a Muslim, that he's no good, and so forth. But many of those who consider themselves conservative have forgotten about this secret and entirely illegal action by the Reagan administration because he's their guy. This lack of consistent principle is all too characteristic of many, many people in the United States today who complain when a policy is being carried out by an administration of a party they don't support, but is passed over in silence or approved of when the very same policy is carried out by an administration of the party they do support. Now, this Iran-Contra deal was not only illegal under American law, it was, of course, a violation of the U.S. Constitution. Ronald Reagan and conservatives make a big thing about the U.S. Constitution, how important it is to follow it. I have a book here written by a son of Ronald Reagan, Michael Reagan. He was the son of Reagan and Jane Wyman, an actress, when the two were married. Michael Reagan is has been an energetic and fervent defender of the legacy of his father. In this book, The City on a Hill, he makes a big thing about the U.S. Constitution. Michael Reagan talks about how the U.S. Constitution compares to railroad tracks, and if a government steps outside the constitutional boundaries, if it does anything more than the Constitution permits, or it does things in contradiction against the Constitution, the government is derailed, and, as he says, there's a train wreck. Well, the Reagan administration violated the Constitution, and one of the specific features or sections of the U.S. Constitution that not only the Reagan administration, but other administrations, other presidential administrations, routinely violate, is Article 1, Section 9. And I'm quoting, "No money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time." Well, of course, the money derived from illegal sale of weapons to Iran and money supplied to the Contras through officials in the White House is, of course, entirely in violation of that. More generally, of course, the American presidents have been violating Article 1, Section 9 for years, in that the budget of the National Security Agency and large parts of the budget of the CIA are not public at all. They're not made by any specific appropriation, and certainly no public account of receipts and expenditures of this public money is published or made part of the record. But that's just one example of many about the Reagan administration, the difference between the rhetoric on the one hand and the reality on the other. Consistent with Reagan's view of the world is his view of history. His view of American history is as a country not only made up of people who settled here with, as he put it, a special love of freedom and a special kind of courage. His view of U.S. history is a very, well, generous one. In a speech that he made in 1982, he said, "Our status as a free society and world power is not based on brute strength. When we've taken up arms, it has been for the defense of freedom for ourselves and for other peaceful nations who needed our help." Well, that might be true some of the time, but to make a statement like that is pretty astonishing, considering two important wars that America has been in that are very hard to explain in terms of altruism or defense of freedom for ourselves and others. I'm thinking specifically of the U.S. war against Mexico, which was a war to defend Americans who they were illegal immigrants, actually, into Mexico that the Mexican government didn't want because they were bringing slaves into the country. And the war was even denounced as illegal by Abraham Lincoln when he was a congressman at the time. It was a war that, as a result of which, the United States acquired large amounts of Mexican territory. But perhaps a better example is the Spanish-American War. This war against Spain in 1898, in fact, prompted an enormous debate in the United States by people for and against the whole concept of imperialism. In fact, those people who applauded and supported the Spanish-American War often did so specifically because they said that as a result of this conflict and the United States' acquisition of the Philippines, of Puerto Rico, and of a protectorate over Cuba from the failing Spanish Empire would give America its own empire. It would make America an imperial country. But it was hardly a war for noble and altruistic reasons, especially considering that in the aftermath of the seizure of the Philippines, far more Americans were killed putting down the rebels in the Philippines who wanted independence from both Spain and the United States than Americans who died actually fighting against the Spanish to acquire the country. Similarly, Reagan, in a speech in 1994, said, "It was leadership here at home that gave us strong American influence abroad and the collapse of imperial communism. Great nations have responsibilities to lead, and we should always be cautious of those who would lower our profile because they might wind up lowering our flag." Well, that's pretty astonishing to claim that strong American leadership was responsible for the collapse of imperial communism. In fact, when communism was in its greatest danger in 1941 and 1942, when it was fighting for its life against the armies of Germany and its allies in World War II, the strongest supporter of Soviet communism was the United States of America. America's most important military ally ever in its history was the Soviet Union in World War II. The Soviet Union finally fell apart in 1989 and 90, not as a result of strong American leadership, but for its own internal contradictions. In fact, I would go beyond that some of the same problems that brought down ultimately the Soviet Union and the Soviet government are some of the same problems that America faces today. In fact, some of the same problems based on an unrealistic sense of the world and of society that Ronald Reagan in some ways personified and expressed. That's why one of the most remarkable features of Ronald Reagan, and perhaps even paradoxical features, is that although he considered himself a conservative who supported small government, he was also an admirer of Franklin Roosevelt. In fact, during World War II, when Roosevelt was president, Ronald Reagan was employed in Hollywood helping to make U.S. propaganda movies for the U.S. government. He narrated a number of them, and in fact, he was an actor in a U.S. Army training film about piloting and shooting down Japanese airplanes. He narrated another propaganda film for the U.S. Army Air Corps praising the African-American flyers of the Tuskegee Institute. But his legacy about President Roosevelt, because Roosevelt was America's leader in World War II, is an odd one, because it was Franklin Roosevelt who, more than any other president in history up until that time, greatly expanded the power and the scope and the influence of the federal government. But it's also especially odd because praising Franklin Roosevelt is very odd from a man who considers himself a conservative. In 1982, Ronald Reagan praised Roosevelt as one of history's truly monumental figures, an American giant, a leader who shaped, inspired, and led our people through perilous times. He said, "Every generation of Americans has faced problems, and every generation has overcome them. Like Franklin Roosevelt, we know that for free men, hope will always be strong, a stronger force than fear, that we only fail when we allow ourselves to be boxed in by the limitations and errors of the past." Reagan also said on another occasion, with his alphabet soup of federal agencies, FDR in many ways set in motion the forces that later sought to create big government and bring in a form of veiled socialism to America. But I think that many people forget Roosevelt ran for president on a platform dedicated to reducing waste and fat in government. He called for cutting federal spending by 25%, eliminating useless boards and commissions, and returning to states and community powers that had been wrongfully seized by the federal government. If he had not been distracted by war, I think he would have resisted the relentless expansion of the federal government that followed him. Well, one scholar comments on this by saying one can see quite a bit of wishful thinking in Reagan's analysis. Well, that's certainly true. But Reagan's legacy is very similar to Roosevelt in that way. It's true that Roosevelt promised actually to cut federal spending, but so did Ronald Reagan. And like President Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan failed to live up to the pledge he made, especially or notably in that very regard. More than that, the idea that for Franklin Roosevelt, World War II was a distraction that kept him from resisting the expansion of federal power is an astonishing one, because it was Franklin Roosevelt, in fact, that was pushing for America to get into the war. And this brings up a much stronger point, and that is that conservatives at the time loathed Franklin Roosevelt, but conservatives consistently end up embracing the legacy and the policies of presidents in the past, no matter how liberal they might be, because the conservative position today is very often the liberal position of 10 or 20 years earlier. To put it another way, the liberal position of 10 or 20 years ago is now the conservative position. And a few examples. I mean, at one time, conservatives were firmly against the Social Security system, which was came into during the New Deal years of Franklin Roosevelt. But now conservative Republicans all claim that they'll administer it better than the Democrats. Almost none of them ever talk about getting rid of it anymore, even though at one time they opposed it. At one time, conservatives were against voting rights for blacks. Now, of course, no conservative would ever dare oppose that. At one time, conservatives were against voting rights for women. Conservatives, of course, wouldn't be caught dead. In fact, many conservative, so-called conservative leaders are themselves women. During the 1960s, those who called themselves conservatives vehemently opposed the demand for civil rights of Martin Luther King. And they specifically opposed the 1964 civil rights law that made it illegal for a private citizen to sell his home or hire someone or serve someone as a customer on the basis of race. Now, so-called conservatives today even embrace Martin Luther King and his legacy, and some even claim that Martin Luther King should actually be considered a conservative. That's odd, but in one sense, that's accurate, because Martin Luther King insisted in his famous I Have a Dream speech, for example, that one should be judged on the basis not of his skin color or race, but rather on the content of his character. And in that sense, that's what conservatives also believe, because their basic worldview is that society is made up of individuals. Conservatives have a hard time saying what it is they want to conserve beyond a sense of individual freedom and rights. Well, however that might be good for people here and now as individuals, it's very hard to sustain a society, a healthy society, over the long run, because a healthy society is more than a collection of individuals. A healthy society is bound together by ethnic or racial or cultural or religious bonds that transcend individual wants or needs or freedoms. To go back to the kind of mystical view that Ronald Reagan had about America's history and its role in the world, over and over, conservatives and Ronald Reagan emphasize this idea that America is this exceptional country that should be and must be a leader in the world. Now, in fact, Michael Reagan, the son of Ronald Reagan, is explicit about this in his book, The City on a Hill. And he says, he concludes, "We must lead the world. That is our mission as citizens of the city on a hill." Well, the problem with that is twofold. First of all, increasingly, America is unable to lead because it isn't an example. It has such great problems here at home, it's hard to make any pretense of being kind of any kind of exemplar in the larger world. And second, how does a country lead if other countries don't want to be led by the United States of America? Increasingly, that means by using force against those countries that don't follow America's self-appointed role as leader in the world. And that's one more reason why the legacy of Ronald Reagan, when people try to apply it in the world today, is a dangerous one, and why it's important to understand the contrast between the reality of the Reagan years and of those who call themselves conservatives in general and the reality. I hope you'll join me for the next Mark Weber report.